You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this December 23rd, Christmas Eve Eve. O. Emmanuel of the O. Antiphons, and I'm pleased to have in the studio my good friend, Father Tom Galloway, pastor of St. Andrew's Orthodox Church here in Lexington, where we broadcast from, and a regular guest on the program. And of course, unlike Easter, where we may have two different dates, Father Tom, we have the same Christmas.
Aha, but there are two different dates.
January 6th?
7th.
Oh, 7th.
Okay, let's first tackle that one. The what's called New Style Calendar, or New Calendar, which is called the Gregorian Calendar, coming from the 16th mm-hmm. century Pope Gregory, now is, well, that's, I would say, perhaps the most single dominant world calendar, okay?
And that replaced the Julian calendar.
There is still the Julian calendar, which is used in church circles as well. Most of the churches in the United States, I would say, let's put it to you this way. The majority of Orthodox worldwide follow January 7th, the date of Christmas, which is December 25th, on the Julian calendar. The majority of Orthodox in North America, not all, the majority of Orthodox in North America follow the Gregorian calendar's date, because they do follow the new calendar in the country, in this country. There are, however, notable exceptions, and there are some Orthodox churches in this country which will be celebrating January 7th as Christmas. My wife, being Serbian, the Serbian church follows January 7th. Ecclesiastically, they still follow the Julian calendar. So she's had the interesting, she never followed the 25th at all until we were married. It was kind of a strange phenomena to her. Now she's able to have Christmas with our family and our house and go through everything liturgically. And then she can go to her, now it's her sister's, was her mother's, go to her sister's home and follow everything of the old calendar on January 7th and the Serbian traditions for Christmas. So I always felt it worked out well. She never wanted to follow two Christmases in her life. But we have done so since we've been married, nearly 35 years. And our children have really thought it was a great idea. Our children have loved having two Christmases.
I'm sure they have.
The sad part is, when I was a child, there was a great deal of emphasis. I think there was an intuitive understanding about Christmas in which it was a seasonal celebration. We didn't start that season in October. You actually celebrated Christmas through the 12 days of Christmas.
Right.
And in fact, in many Catholic circles as well, the Feast of Epiphany many times was referred to as Little Christmas. It was with many of my relatives. And we followed it all the way through. So people didn't throw their trees out on the 26th. Your tree was up. Oh, it had to be up for New Year's. You were strange if you didn't have your tree up for New Year's. And your tree was up past Epiphany.
So let me go back just for a minute to something you said. So when there's different dates, it's not a question of whether December 25th is Christmas. It's which calendar you go by. Right.
Yeah. The calculations now, and it won't change for probably a full day for another century, the end of the century. But the Julian and Gregorian calendars, as we have discussed a little bit in the past, I could get into that again with you, are both used ecclesiastically in the Orthodox world. And it's December 25th on the Julian calendar when it's January 7th on the Gregorian calendar.
So there used to be 12 days between them, now 13?
Well, you know, I think you're missing the point in that the 25th to the 6th. So if you're using the Julian calendar, you're going the 7th to the 19th.
Right.
That's the 12 days of Christmas.
I see.
So they're not going to be celebrating Epiphany then till the 19th,
the 19th of January. See. Makes sense.
Hey, okay, I'll give you some noted countries that do that. Egypt, Armenia, Patriarchate of Jerusalem, the Serbian Orthodox Church, the Russian Orthodox Church, and the Ukrainian Orthodox Church.
Yeah, I had a friend who was a missionary in Lviv, Ukraine, and he always talked about that.
And all of those who are, let's say, descendants or appendage churches to them. Mm-hmm. So those in the United States, who would be celebrating January 7th for Christmas? Serbian churches, many of the Ukrainian churches, jurisdiction of the Moscow Patriarchate in the United States. You know, churches in Europe which are attached to the Moscow Patriarchate, where people have immigrated. Our Coptic brothers, the Coptic Orthodox Church from Egypt, the Armenian Orthodox Church, all of them will be, you know, are still going to be celebrating January 7th as their religious or spiritual holiday. Mm-hmm.
So a large swath of peoples.
Sure. You know what? It worked out great. If you look at my wife's from Beaver County, Pennsylvania, and you know, bedrock place of America.
Beaver Falls from there?
Beaver Falls is one of the towns in Beaver County.
Joe Namath.
I rented the tuxedos from my wedding at the shop next door to Joe Namath's mom's store.
Wow.
And we shopped, you know, we said hi to Mom Namath when we got them.
Mount Montana from that area, too, I believe.
Montana. Johnny Unitas isn't from far away. Dan Marino's from far away. You know, Western Pennsylvania is the cradle of quarterbacks.
There you go.
And anyway, I was married in Midland, Pennsylvania, little town also in Beaver County. And January 7th was a legal holiday. It worked out well in those days because, you know, people want to be off for Christmas. Hospitals, steel mills, a lot of the industries, they couldn't just shut down. They had to have people there. So people who celebrated January 7th all worked on the 25th. And they took their holiday on January 7th. So the Serbians, Ukrainian churches, the Russian churches up there, the Coptic Church in Beaver County, they all, you know, it was a great symbiotic relationship between the communities.
Mm-hmm.
On January 7th, my wife and her family, of course, always got off school. It was amazing the evangelism that was. Every Italian, Mexican, throughout the town was Serbian for a day. And they all wanted to have January 7th. And, you know, my father-in-law was such a hospitable man. His doors were always open. He would never use paper plates. He would put on an apron and wash plates. It was Christmas. But anybody who came to his home, he fed anyone who came to his home. And as the shifts changed at the hospitals, waves of nurses would come, people would come. And so it was a wonderful feel in the whole town.
Sure.
You know, we had a town of about 9,000 to 10,000 people. The Serbian Orthodox Church in that town was about 350 families, so it was a sizable congregation. And the presence was very noticeable, you know, for all the festivities of the Serbian community. And you know, everybody, I think it was a wonderful trade-off. So some of the churches where I grew up, you know, had followed one calendar or another. Some of them changed in my lifetime. You know, the people had decided to vote to go to the new calendar. But you had a real sense of season. Today, I don't feel that. And to tell you the truth, in Lexington, for its appearance of churches everywhere is not really a very moving spiritual town in that respect.
Mm. What is your take on, and we're at this again because Christmas falls on a Sunday, you know,
sure.
You have many of these large evangelical churches who never in the past have church on Christmas Day. They've always had Christmas Eve services, but here on a Sunday even, no church on Christmas Day.
Did they make that decision again this year?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
I know last time this occurred, it was a CNN reported story nationwide about the little bit of a controversy here in Lexington. Myself, I'm going to tell you, I find no excuse for a church to be either closed or empty on a Sunday morning. And the blessings of religious liberty, though in the freedom of which we have, why would we choose that?
Hmm.
You have the freedom to do that, but why would you make that? I was just reading an article the other day about the churches in Mosul in Iraq, and this is going to be the third year in which there'll be no Christmas in the city of Mosul. People say, well, that's so far away. Why do we care? You know, until 3 years ago, there was never a Sunday from the end of the first into the second century in which the gospel was not read, Jesus Christ was not preached, the liturgy was not celebrated in the city of Mosul until 3 years ago.
Wow.
So you ask yourself, if you let it go, what's next?
Hmm. We're going to have to go to break. We'll be back in just a minute with my good friend, Father Tom Galloway, Orthodox priest, Antiochian Orthodox, to be specific. We'll be back on the other side of the break. If you want to give us a call, 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
That's the hour. You're back on the Mike Allen Show. Man, you all miss some of the best conversations that we have off air. We'll see if we can translate those over. It's him here with my friend, Father Tom Galloway, the pastor of St. Andrew's Orthodox Church here in Lexington, Kentucky, where we broadcast from. He's a monthly guest, and we're talking about, of course, the Feast of the Nativity. Now, Father Tom, I'll ask you, we're sitting here. Do the Orthodox recognize or use the O antiphons in their liturgical life, these seven titles of Christ? Probably not, since they're in the Latin.
No, it's a liturgical practice we don't have, and I haven't studied the origins of that. I'm sure there may be some connections because the word antiphon.
Boethius, I think, is where you see them first mentioned.
And the term antiphon actually goes back in the Latin Church to St. Ambrose of Milan. And people may also know that Milan, and there is a separate rite, which is a little different than the Roman rite, which is used in that area, called the Ambrosian rite.
Mm.
It's one of the rites that actually starts Advent the same time we do, mid-November.
Speaking of Milan, you heard they've killed the truck driver from Berlin. In Milan this morning.
Okay. I had not heard that. Well, he actually, in his writings, reveals that he brought the idea of the antiphon, which meaning there's a right and a left choir.
Mm-hmm.
And he did so by borrowing the manner as they do in the East. Antiphons are a part of our all of our
liturgies. I knew you'd find a way to get credit.
The truth is the truth. The light that comes from the East. And the idea of antiphonal singing, of singing left and right.
Right.
For instance, in our service of the Nativity, there is what we have, what's called canons. Now, these canons are hymnography, you know, of nine different odes. And there is one that is begin to be sung at a point in Advent, and then there's one that's sung right afterwards. as a replacement. But on Christmas itself, both are sung, a right and a left choir. So we'll have two choirs doing the antiphons. But the word antiphon and antiphonal singing is a part of every Eucharistic liturgy of the Orthodox Church. So, it was very prevalent to use these in Eastern liturgies, and St. Ambrose brought that tradition. And the Ambrosian tradition perhaps has a little more emphasis on the antiphonal singing than the other rites in the West, especially the Roman rite, which has now been the dominant rite at sometimes, I think, a little bit at the expense of the others.
But the whole idea of the O antiphons, because of their Latin title, I mean, in the East.
It's probably from the Latin tradition, yeah, that particular. Yeah.
But from the East, you tend to favor the Greek over the Latin.
I think that would be a little obvious.
I would think so. That's why we were talking about biblical translations. And you would not see, but let me ask this, in Orthodox seminaries, mm-hmm. probably not study Hebrew, right? Because you would draw from the Septuagint for your
Old
Testament text.
Actually, we had a wonderful professor who did teach Hebrew as well. I thought it was very important that all the biblical languages.
But I have a good friend who contends, and I don't know enough, I don't know whether he's right, but he says that if you look in terms of the integrity of the text, the Septuagint has more integrity in terms of its correspondence to ancient documents than does the Hebrew,
yeah.
the Masoretic text that we have.
Well, I'll tell you, the Orthodox Church wouldn't entirely concur with that. In fact, it's actually older than the current text, which is the Hebrew text.
Mm. The Septuagint, by the way, just for those who don't know, is the Greek translation of the Old Testament.
It was done by Hellenistic Jews. It has the name Septuagint because it says of the 70, it means of the 70. There were 72. The story is there were 72 scholars. Egypt, and particularly with the library in Alexandria, was one of the greatest centers of learning in the world. And there was a commissioning to have all of the Hebrew scriptures translated into Greek for the Hellenistic Greek-speaking world, which was a dominant intellectual language, which had been spread from India to Europe. So this project was an enormous project was underway. And as they did this, they had to make judgment calls to the real meaning of various verses. This is critical for Christianity. Critical in several instances. The most notable one is when you get into the passage in Isaiah about the birth of Christ, and that it was going to be, was it a maiden?
Mm.
Was it a young woman? Or was it a virgin who was going to give birth? There was no conflict. It was immediately there is that the word virgin was chosen. Greek is a more exact and varied language. Hebrew is open to a little bit of interpretation, less exact.
And this was done, obviously, before the virgin birth.
This was done within the century of the birth of Christ. So it's critical. And a second point. The Septuagint, okay, the Greek Old Testament, was also the one used by the church. It was the one used by the apostles, and it was the one used by the early church. That was the version that was used
by our Lord?
Well, in the synagogue he grew up with, I doubt it. But when the church was entering into the world and was using the scriptures, if you see the judgment calls, of course, when they quote from the Old Testament, where are they quoting from?
You mean in the Gospels?
You know, they're leaning a little bit. Well, okay, let's examine the verse. Does the New Testament say a maiden,
mm-hmm.
a young woman, or does it say that Christ be born of a virgin? So, you know, that verse from Isaiah, immediately, there's a sense of commentary or interpretation that was done through the Septuagint, which was interlinked. We see it as one of the many things on the convergence of, you know, the Gospels use the language in the fullness of time, that it was then that Christ was to be born, because all these other things had been prepared in advance. If we take a step back in history, the Orthodox are going to say it wasn't just the flow of the Old Testament. It just wasn't the sacred history, as the good Germans would say, the Heilige Geschichte of the Jewish nation. We see the preparations for Christ happening multiculturally, in that where had even the philosophy had come with the Greeks, the its end conclusion without something else. We can see that the whole panorama came to that very moment. So in response to the once very, very popular musical, Jesus Christ Superstar, why were you born in such a strange place in such a strange time? Why didn't you wait for mass communications of the BBC? Because really, it was at that moment the world was ripe, the world was ready. Preparations both in the general society, the secular or Greco-Roman world, the fulfillment of the prophecies that had come throughout all the Semitic peoples. It came to that moment when Jesus was to be born.
And we could probably thank Alexander the Great for the Hellenistic influence.
Well, I think, you know, there are those who would say that, you know, Alexander was part of this whole process.
Mm-hmm. Now, and it's also, just as an aside, I mean, the Septuagint contains the books that Protestants reject but that we embrace, sometimes
yes,
called the Deuterocanon,
yes.
Or what they call the Apocrypha.
The Apocrypha is not really a very good term for it. I like to say this to all of our evangelical brothers and sisters, and to our all English speakers of the world, that, you know, I see a lot of people talking about the King James Bible. King James Bible was a masterful work and a great wordsmith for the English language. And the thing is that people say, oh, we want to have the King James Bible. But all of those books were in King James's Bible. And they were, you know, an integral part of the thinking, the spiritual thinking. That. So I think that, you know, they also play a great role. They were used by the church, and it was part of the church until the post-reformational era.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the reformational, post-reformational era, when there was a reformed Bible put together, which, interestingly enough, did not seek Christian sources. The odd thing is, take somebody like Martin Luther, an interesting character we can talk about another time. But Martin Luther, being the staunch, very a German Christian leader, actually was not particularly at times fond of the Jewish population in Germany. However,
that's putting it mildly.
Well, we have to at least be polite. He wasn't particularly. Yet, they turned as a source. Should we use the Old Testament that has been used by the Christian church for 1,500 years, 1,600 years, or should we turn to the Jews and find out what the Old Testament should be?
We're going to have to go to break. We'll be back. We'll get back into this with Father Tom Galloway. If you've got a comment or a question, 573-4BREAD-4. When we come back, I also want to talk about Russia a little bit and Syria from your Orthodox perspective. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Christmas Eve, this O Emmanuel edition of the Mike Allen Show. Blessed to have you in the studio, Father Tom Galloway, who is the pastor of St. Andrew's Orthodox Church, Antiochian Orthodox, here in Lexington, a regular guest on the program. And we always have more, you know, you heard the whole thing about running out of money before you run out of month. We always seem to run out of time before we run out of topics. But I am asking a question today. What do you folks typically eat on Christmas morning? Different things. Now, you'll have Mass Christmas morning, right?
Yeah, this year I'm not going to be eating at all. I'm going to wait till I have liturgy.
Right, and then after the liturgy.
Well, that's when I go home. In dinner, yeah, we're going to have some very specific foods I have every year, combining the cultures of my household.
Now, do you have, I'm assuming you have vigil Christmas Eve as well?
Well, this year, since Christmas falls on Sunday, our order of services will be a little bit altered. In that this morning at 10 o'clock, which is Friday morning for your listeners, if they're listening on Bedbox Media, that I'll have the what's called the Royal Hours, the Liturgy of the Hours for the Nativity this morning. Normally, it would be the morning of Christmas Eve, but since it's Sunday, it's a little different order of service. Tomorrow evening, I'll be having the Great Vespers with the Litia, the blessing of wheat, wine, and oil, and special loaves on Saturday evening at 5:30. And then Sunday morning, I did drop services down a half an hour, and we're going to be doing the Orthros or Matin service with the double canon we spoke of in the first half hour, which will be done at 9:30, and the liturgy will be at 10:30. So,
is there any tradition of midnight Mass in
Orthodox? Our parish in Louisville has had a longstanding tradition. That's when the people there are most frequently doing. And I believe they're doing it this year. I'll have to check their website, but frequently they do it, or something very late in the evenings. Some churches are trying to shortcut a little bit and do them earlier, or not do something on Sunday morning. Even in the Orthodox Church, they're doing them on Saturday evening. Personally, let's put it this way, my personal opinion. I do not want to do that. And I'm not doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And in general, our bishops have never wanted us to do that either. I think that having on Sunday morning is, for this year, a particularly most important statement to make.
It is a mystery of mysteries, the incarnation. How do you get your mind around the infinite God becoming, taking on flesh?
It's one of the most over-dominant themes of theology that permeates the Orthodoxy. In fact, I would say it's one of the, if you look at, for those who are unfamiliar, your listeners who are unfamiliar with the Orthodox, the Byzantine rite practices, there are, when a bishop is serving, there are two what appear to be small candelabras in which he on the altar and which he uses at times in the service. He's accompanied by in processions. One has three candles, one has two candles. And in the right hand, he has the trikerion, which is three candles. And in the left hand, he has one, it's called a dikerion, which is the two candles. And it's part of the great majesty and the pageantry of the Orthodox Byzantine Rite liturgy. But what do they stand for? Well, those are the two foundational doctrines. One is the Holy Trinity, and one is the dual nature of Christ, the three and the two. Those are the foundations in which everything else is made manifest, shown, bedrocked, referred to. So the incarnation, from the earliest days and particularly from the explosion of the Christological statements of the 4th century onward at the ecumenical councils, the incarnation has been with the theme. Okay, the theme, I think. And you can find the identity of Christ and the affirmations of him. That was the theme of all the original 7 ecumenical councils.
Mm-hmm.
At one stage, one phase, one nuance or another, to protect the very truth of the incarnation, that God actually came and took flesh, dwelt among us, entered into death, conquered the fear of death for us, and opened up, you know, the entire kingdom of heaven, but brought heaven to earth, that we can experience and taste it now.
and opened heaven for us, fully human, fully divine. Now, I wanted to get to this because I want to make sure we don't run out of time. There's been a lot of talk, of course, with the recent presidential election, you know, Russia, been all in the news, you know, Russia hacking and, you know, Putin's influence. And there's this, been this very interesting maybe rehabilitation of Russia politically in the minds of Americans since the fall of Soviet communism. And now you've had the emergence of Putin, former KGB agent, right? But now is being viewed by some as almost the protector of Western Christian culture, you know, by some, as opposed to seeing Russia as the atheist, communist, you know, the world conquering, you know, there used to be a lot of fear about Russia. And it's almost flip-flop. There used to be sympathy on the left for the Soviet Union and a suspicion on the right. Now it's almost come full circle to where the left are the voices criticizing Putin, and then you have those on the right who are more warm and friendly.
Well, we haven't turned our minds enough. Okay, I'd like to speak to this topic. I anticipated it coming today. So let's address it. Americans are at a great disadvantage in discussing this topic, and I'll tell you why. First of all, most of us who are alive today or grew up who are in positions of authority in the United States, government, teachers, whatever, grew up during what was known as the Cold War.
Right.
In which we were sort of at odds and rivalry with the Soviet Union, as President Reagan once called them, the evil empire. You just imagine Darth Vader breathing in the background, you know.
Or Ivan Drago from Rocky IV, you know.
Yeah, you know. I mean, and we really don't know hardly anything about Russia, but we talk about it all the time. We don't know the history of Russia. I thought it was interesting, all these commentators on the news, you know, the people who learn how to do their hair and nails, but they know nothing about world affairs. Babbling the other day about how they were all great at the sorority house. But they don't know anything about history because they're talking about Russia's intervention, interfering into the affairs of Syria. Well, let's address that. Okay? Russia has had a connection into Syria. If there's anybody who's interfered, it's the United States. Russia has had a vested interest, a presence, and a vital link into Syria for centuries. We're talking way pre-Soviet era. We're talking centuries of the Tsarist era.
Is it true that Orthodox Christians in Syria looked for...
They begged Russia to
Russia,
come.
They always looked to Russia.
Always looked to Russia.
For protection.
You know, we don't even understand the existence of once was called the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire, we're not allowed to speak against it today, of course. It's not politically correct. And as you notice, anything I am is not politically correct. Well, in the days of the Ottoman Empire, you know, Christians were around to pay taxes and to help finance it. They used to actually tax their sons to make them Muslims and fighters. Which you don't allow to talk about now either, called the Dev Shermam. But in Syria, Syria had become impoverished, and the Christians there were always in a precarious situation. Frequently, there were persecutions. I have mentioned this on the show before, but until what's called the Mamluk era, the Mamluks had taken over Syria, one of the many different Turkic Muslim groups that had ruling dynasties. The majority of Syria, despite the presence of Islam, remained Christian till then, and their massive persecutions and slaughter that occurred under the Mamluks. Emerging from that in the Ottoman era, Christians would appeal, and they would travel to Russia, the only free, non-occupied Orthodox nation. The Tsar of Russia, and this is where we go back to a perception of social and political understanding, had assumed this position in world affairs known as the Third Rome. The First Rome had fallen into heresy. I'm sorry, that's the Pope. The Second Rome.
I might take issue with that, but continue.
The Second Pope, or the Second
Constantinople.
Constantinople had fallen to the infidels, to the Turks. The only free nation who could pick up the torch of truth and to the light of the world was Russia. So the Tsar of Russia, the name Tsar means what? Caesar.
Right.
Saw himself as the continuation. In fact, the Russian great Russian prince married one of the last princesses of Byzantium. So show there's both a physical as well as an ideological extent. And they became, and this was an official title granted by the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire to the Tsar of Russia, that he was the protector of Christians.
We'll pick this back up in just a minute with my guest, the politically correct Father Tom Galloway.
Always.
Always. We'll be back in just a minute. This is the Mike Allen Show. If you want to chime in, 573-4BREAD-4. We'll be back.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show. December 23rd, 2 days away from the Feast of the Nativity, here with my good friend, Father Tom Galloway. Always insightful, always opinionated, never politically correct. His own no-spin zone. He's here, the pastor of St. Andrew's Orthodox Church here in Lexington. Boys, getting him wound up during the commercial break. Too bad you weren't here to hear it. Talking about Russia, no. Syria, all the rest. So let me just devil's advocate here. Okay? Good Catholic term, devil's advocate. You like Assad in Syria. I mean,
he's no Boy Scout.
I mean, is it kind of like the situation in Iraq, for example, where you had Saddam Hussein, who was also no Boy Scout, but
there is a marked difference, even though both of them were both good to the Christian churches.
I mean, Assad has dropped barrel bombs on people, okay? Killed children, right?
Assad, who hasn't killed children? In Vietnam, they used to greet our veterans walking off the planes as baby burners. Assad is no more guilty than Richard Nixon, LBJ. How about the firebombing of Dresden in the 1940s? War is a terrible thing. Let's just agree that war is itself. It's a sinful, terrible thing. That is a horror, that there is nothing good about war. Okay? We pray for the military at every service in the Orthodox Church. And we pray for the military, and we hope that they're going to be, that they can keep the safe and they keep the peace. But we also pray that they never are used. Okay, it's a very dreadful thing. That's a whole ethical discussion we can have one day about the military. But let's face it, this is a terrible war. This was a war which was incited and financed. Okay, incited and financed by the United States, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf states. The same people who gave money to the rebels in Syria, which are Al-Qaeda affiliates in general. Okay.
Looking for a more pure Islamic
Are the
republic.
Same people whose oil we buy, it's our money, okay, and they're financing the overthrow of a legitimate government in Syria, and they wanted to incite a civil war. There is nothing more vicious on earth than a civil war.
Was the idea that Assad was not sufficiently Muslim, too secular? as a ruler, part of the so-called Arab Spring?
Partially. The Arab Spring, which was a PR piece created in some spin zone in Washington, D.C., the Orthodox who are from the region always refer to it as the tornado.
Mm-hmm.
What? Tell me one good thing that's come out of it.
Not for Christians, certainly.
I can't see any good thing in any country it touched. From Tunisia all the way around to Turkey, it's been bad. Assad and the Assad regime, he did not want to be president. He wasn't supposed to be president. He's a physician. Okay, he's a doctor. And he was living in Great Britain when he was recalled by the country. And he was elected president. Some people have things thrust upon them, whether they want them or not. And actually, he embraced much of the ideology, but he also had a very progressive ideology personally. He had some of his biggest political problems inside Syria were with his father's advisors and people still left from his father's regime. But Syria, I can tell you, I was there in the Christmas season and did Christmas shopping there back in 2004. I did my Christmas shopping at Damascus and Beirut that year, being overseas. And I can tell you, it was, for the Christian, there was many articles in the subsequent couple of years after I came back, I read several that talked about it being a real oasis, a real paradise for Christians. Their legal status, their ability, their freedom, their openness. It was a beautiful sight to stand on a mountain in Damascus. There was a restaurant complex on top of a mountain overlooking the city. And at night, I kind of like neon sometimes. I remember my childhood, neon. And all the crosses on tops of the churches were all outlined in neon. And so you looked out over the city of Damascus and you saw all these crosses at night. It was a great statement. It was peaceful. The second most admired figure in the nation is the patriarch of the church, and Muslims called him the head of our church. Think about that statement. They were so joyously decorating Christmas. Muslims celebrated Christmas over there with their Christian brothers. They love Christmas in Syria. I rarely saw a more joyous place, a people wanting to decorate and enjoy and laugh and love about Christmas in my life. To see that nation now, a decade later, in such shambles, and have the hate words sown in to the country, it's unfathomable. And so I have so many Syrians which have gone through shock over this. Assad was a protector of the Christians in that he maintained a society in which they were fully integrated, fully expressional, no interference in their communities. He was a frequent guest at some of the convents and the orphanages. He would go to the orphanages run by the church and was a welcomed guest. We had some of our hierarchs who were extremely outspoken in support of him. In general, when the war started, the church wanted neutrality. They said, listen, we're not going to get into the politics of this. It quickly degenerated from this student-led democratic supposed revolution, wanting more democracy, to an armed conflict, well-financed. The second element of this was not just internals of rebellion movements. The Assads are from a sect which has been now marked as Shiite. The majority of the country was Sunni. Mm-hmm. That's one element of conflict. The second element of conflict was the emergence of a group in Arabic which is known as Daesh. We know them as ISIS, mm-hmm, or ISIL, as they like to say on CNN. And they want this group, which is international in financing and scope. The fighters came from all over, including the United States, France, all over the West.
And they're Sunni.
They are Sunni. And they, as they, one of them screamed the other day, you know, we are the descendants. We are the ones of the prophet of Muhammad's jihad. And you can now see a taste of what the Middle East went through at the coming of the prophet Muhammad. And you see this this terrible bloodbath which occurred under their reign, where if you know why are they blowing up all these historic sites, monuments, destroying museums, destroying Palmyra, a crime against humanity? Same way the Taliban blew up all the monuments of the earlier kings of the Buddhist kings that once were in Afghanistan. They want to erase everything before the Prophet. Before Muhammad. It's of no value. It's why the library in Alexandria was burned. All of these things. And they want to reestablish the caliphate. They see as the only legitimate form of government. No presidents, no nationalities. And this was being, I think, manipulated a little bit by the West as well. Maps were already circulating in the Middle East 2 years before this war that no longer had borders on Syria. Now, this was in the works. And I think that people set forces in motion thinking they could control them for their political ends. And once it gets going, it took a life of its own and they couldn't control it.
Here with Father Tom, we got about a minute and a half left, but we're not going to get to Dalek Catechism today. We'll just set that aside. But I think you had did you have a text or something you were wanting to read over there?
Well, no, I just wanted to comment to people that we.
Because I'd love to have a prayer from you as well as we approach Christmas.
We would like to just talked about the both the Septuagint and the quote apocrypha Deuterocanonical books, and the very word epiphany. Where does it first emerge? Well, it comes out of, you know, meaning manifestation, a manifestation of God. It first occurs, it's a Greek word, from the Septuagint in 2 Maccabees, verse 27. I wanted to give just a little reference to people. They can use their Catholic Bibles, your Orthodox Bibles, to find it. And it says, finding in their hands and praying to God with their hearts, they laid low at least 35,000, rejoiced greatly over this manifestation of God's power. And that's the first time that the word is used. And the word of manifestation, which is giving the word, is epiphany.
Epiphanos, yes.
And you will also, in the we can talk about this next time, the practice of the Orthodox Church on this feast day, but that is the 12th night, the 12th day of Christmas. And it is also sometimes in the Orthodox world referred to as theophany, because it's a manifestation of God. Okay, so it's, both of those words are considered rather interchangeably.
We're going to have to wrap it up now, Father Tom. Thank you so much. Blessings to you and to your family. A most blessed Feast of the Nativity and Christmas season. And we'll turn it around and get you on soon in 2017.
Christ is born. Glorify him.
We'll be back. This is the Mike Allen Show.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.